All right, welcome everybody to our latest Between the Races podcast on the MX Vice Network. Thank you for listening and supporting the site. We really appreciate it. Obviously, we'd firstly like to thank our sponsor for this episode in Fly Racing. Fly Racing is aimed to provide customers with the very best in off-road performance products, led by the revolutionary Formula S Smart Helmet. Fly Racing continues to push innovation in safety to new levels. Never before has style and technology blended together so seamlessly as the 2024 Fly Racing lineup. For more info, check out flyracing.com or your local Western Power Sports dealer, or follow at Fly Racing USA on social media and cheer for all of the Fly Racing riders in the Super Motocross World Championship. Obviously, firstly, welcome Jason Thomas. How's life, mate? And thanks again for joining us. Obviously, the season's in full swing and we're looking at another mudder, aren't we?
Let's hope not. But yeah, there's a pretty strong chance of it. Unfortunately, it's been raining a lot. And, you know, this race is in Birmingham, Alabama, which many listeners will have no idea where that is. But it's a new venue for Supercross, and they've had a ton of rain lately, and then we're supposed to get more rain on Friday and Saturday. So I think it's going to be a soft race no matter what. Let's just hope it's not San Francisco, you know, full-on mud race style. But, man, it certainly could be.
Yeah, absolutely, mate. Obviously, we've got Adam Sterry back on this one. We've just done a podcast with him. So cheers for joining us again to chat some Supercross and MXGP.
Yeah, no, good. All right, JT, nice to see you, mate.
What's up, man?
Yeah, good to jump on with you guys again. Yeah, good. Just training away. Ready for the start of MXGP. So long off season, but a lot of hard work in the wet. Similar to what they're going through in the Supercross, a lot of wet mud and ruts and rain and freezing cold. But hopefully them months are behind now. And yeah, back to the good weather. First good day weather riding today in the sun. And yeah, it just makes it so much more enjoyable. So looking forward to that and looking forward to getting the race underway.
Yeah, fingers crossed, mate. Obviously, welcome Brad Wheel, MX Vice Tester as well. You're praying for some good weather too, aren't you, mate?
Yeah, getting a bit fed up with the rain now and the snow and just the general winter month. Ready to get out and do a proper bit of testing on the YAM. So, yeah, things do seem to be looking up though in the coming weeks. So, fingers crossed.
Yeah, absolutely, mate. Hopefully I can send some of the weather your way. Obviously, summer here in Australia, kind of where I am, 30 degrees every day. So I won't sort of rub that in any further. But yeah, JT, just recap Daytona. How was it from your perspective? Obviously, the track was brutal. Got very savage, ruts everywhere like you were doing in your post-race show there. The whoops were completely eaten up. And I guess it was a bit of a war zone. And Jet Lawrence sort of showed them how it was done. The lap times were crazy. He was doing just so much faster than a lot of the guys. I think it was 4.5 seconds faster. Best lap time than someone like Cooper Webb, which you wouldn't expect. But how was it from your perspective?
Yeah, Jet was phenomenal. The track was really, really difficult. They kind of built a busier layout than normal. And then when you add in that it was really soft going in, a lot of sand sections, like more, if you notice from watching on the broadcast, that the dirt was really dark, almost black. That's from using a lot of sand. You know, they used a lot of the dirt that was already there, versus bringing or building a base out of orange clay, which they've done, you know, over the last 10 or 15 years at times. So that certainly led to a more treacherous racetrack, ruddier, and just tougher. You could argue that using orange clay would have been much more susceptible to a mud race, right? Because they were expecting rain. And I think that was part of their decision-making process was, hey, it's been raining here nonstop. Let's do everything we can to let this rain soak in, which that black sand will give it the best chance. So maybe that was wise, but it certainly created a tough racetrack for the riders. But yeah, to your point, Jet was amazing. He was putting rhythm sections together consistently that other riders couldn't or wouldn't. And he just looked the part. You know, he went out there. I think everybody, but I think between Cooper Webb, Eli Tomac, and Jet, they were all trying to send a message to each other. And only one of, you know, I think one of them was going to get that point across, and Jet certainly came out, you know, with that honor, winning his first ever Daytona, stopping the momentum that Eli Tomac seemed to have gained. And I kind of look at it this way. If you take Jet out of that race and say Jet's still on a 250, it would have been business as usual. It would have been the same old thing. Eli would have won the race. We would have been talking about how he's unbeatable at Daytona. Nobody can touch him. That's six in a row, you know, seven of eight, all those things. But that's not what we saw. We saw this kid come in that really showed everybody that there is another level to be had at Daytona. And he was able to not only reach it, but sustain it over the course of 21 minutes. So it was a dominating performance. And I think more importantly, the mental aspect of that win, you know, the silence was deafening as far as what that win meant to everyone else.
Absolutely. You go, Adam.
Do you think the experience of him racing in Europe on a track like Daytona helped a lot more in that situation? With it being a bit more sand in the ruts, it's kind of, yeah, I was not there, but looking on the TV, when it's more of a sand track like that, it's kind of like when you have to like layer up the preseason race at the weekend when you have a rhythm section that gets like the G out before the actual jump takeoff into ruts.
Yeah.
I can imagine it's a bit more like that rather than a normal supercross track.
Yeah, I think it had to have, right? You know, I certainly think that was the case for Tom Vial. I think the way he was able to kind of just ride away from everybody in the 250 class, you could see his experience in those conditions shining through. I just don't know, you know, like Jet left when he was pretty young. So did he spend enough time there to really develop that? Probably some, yes. But I think Jet's talent and ability is just something that's uncommon. He's just one of those riders that I think is going to change the sport big picture and long term. And when the conditions are their most difficult and the ask is the tallest of the riders, then I think you really see people's skill sets shine through. And that's what Daytona was. You know, if it's an easy racetrack, fast, everybody can kind of go the same speed. I don't think you get to see the differentiation that Jet can bring, but when the track is brutal like that, and it could be, you know, MXGP, there's many races like that, you know, better than I do, that many, you know, the hard pack tracks like Teuchenthal, or, you know, of course the sand too, but those technical tracks where you have to use all of your balance and skill standing up, accelerating through ruts. We don't really have that in America. Guys don't really have to develop that skill set. Jet has that. And I think he's able to exploit it on a track like Daytona, to your point.
Yeah, like I think, trying to think now, I don't even know any, or off the top of my head, can't think of any racetrack on the MXGP calendar where it's similar, like perfect to like an American track. Like we never have that fast, flowing, wide, like nice corners, nice dirt type of track. It's always like, even like a hard patch track like Teuchenthal, it's just ruts on the landing through to the corner. Horrible deep ruts where you can't lean over properly, and they're not round the corner perfect, and then you go from Lama to like Czech Republic with big stones and nothing to turn on with no grip.
Maybe Argentina would be like the closest, and it's so fast it's hard to really compare, but it's like the only track I could think of that doesn't have the slow, ruddy technical aspect that you're talking about.
Yeah, and the big jumps with the speed that keeps flowing and the wide corners. Yeah, I think, I guess that's right. Yeah, that's probably the closest. Although, have you been to Argentina before?
I haven't.
It's like kind of a strange, like the track, fast and stuff like that, but it's kind of a strange, it's like volcanic, the dirt's like volcano.
Sure.
It's like, and there you have like the roots come through from the trees. And like you get the shadows, so there's also really, really strange dirt. But as far as like the speed and the jumps and the track layout, yeah, that's pretty similar to America, I'd guess.
Yeah, you can see Argentina, how tricky it is at times. I'm trying to think if it was Ruben Fernandez or someone. You have these really strange crashes where they kind of lose traction and then catch traction, and then kind of fly over the handlebars for no reason. And that's it's a, you know, tell all of how tricky the dirt is. It looks perfect, but it's not at all, right? The traction is much trickier than it looks.
Yeah, that's just, I think, most trucks. Like you see it on the TV, and then if you go there in person, it's like Daytona look like bad on the on the broadcast. So I can imagine how bad it was when you was actually there. That's the same with the GP tracks. You know, some of them look easy, but you don't see the stones or the square edge bumps or the ruts in the corners. I think sometimes the AMA does a better job also of showing like the track, you know, like what you do, you know, when you go to a section of the supercross track and you show what it actually looks like from a personal point of view. I think MXGP could maybe incorporate something like that, because a lot of people, even who watch MXGP all the time, they don't know what the track looks like. It looks easy. Like, I'll sit at home on the sofa if I'm last 2 years not raced every MXGP and watched it and thought, yeah, that looks not dodgy, you know, but I've been there and raced it. I know what it's like. So I think,
yeah, I think yeah, there's so, one time in my history of going to MXGP races, I think Majora one time was, I wanted to actually ride the track. I don't think there's ever been another time where I was like, I would actually like to ride this.
You said just a minute ago, Adam, I've asked several times to the MXGP people about having someone down on the track like JT does in the Supercross, so the people at home watched on telly have, like, you can actually get down, see the track, see where the lines are, and like you said, the routes coming up through, because you don't see tree routes coming up through on TV in Argentina, you just wouldn't think it. But yeah, like you said, those are the sort of things that I think would benefit MXGP TV. But just changing subjects slightly, if with the weather coming in for this weekend and Jet obviously coming off the back of it's like 1.8 good performances minus the last couple laps the week before, but obviously confidence is running high. But if we're going into a mud race, historically so far this year, as mud races have not been great, what do you think his mindset is? Is it still confident, or is it sort of, well, I need to just sort of get through this one, or is he going out for the win?
Well, I'm talking to, you know, people on his team manager, people around him. The mud really hasn't been so much about the riding. It's been his inability to get a good start in those situations. Mm-hmm. And then, as you all know, in a mud race, if you start in the back, you can't see anything. And then if you fall over, you can't hold onto the motorcycle anymore because everything's so slippery. And it's basically impossible to do much at that point. So they are looking at it more of, put yourself into a good situation and everything will be fine. It doesn't matter if it's muddy or dry. You can certainly ride the mud as good as anyone. But if you're 14th on the first lap and you can't see anything, then your chances of getting on the podium are not so good. So we'll see if they've got that sorted out. I know they've done a ton of testing on, you know, a slippery, like, grate versus dry, trying to get him more comfortable, because I don't know if you guys have paid attention, but on the broadcast, we've tried to do a good job of showing replays of him just spinning like crazy behind the gate when it's been wet. So they've done a ton of testing with the ECU and trying to get clutch delivery better. So, you know, it doesn't have to be perfect, but he certainly can't be last, which is what he was in San Diego, and he was damn close to last in San Francisco.
Do you think on the starts, obviously, yeah, you said he's been struggling off to get off the gate when the conditions are wetter. Do you think he's almost better off just knocking all the electronic aids out the window and just going off sort of instinct and just pure ability and sort of like the feel? Just have like the whole shot device and then just go off what he feels is right at the time.
From what they say, he's getting too excited, you know, and to lower the chances of getting that wheel spin, you've got to keep the RPMs down, right? And he's getting anxious and not remembering the plan when he gets up there and not understanding or remembering that it's wet and someone will rev higher than him next to him and he'll feel like he's really low in the RPM range. Like, I'm going to get a bad start because my RPMs are too low. And so he'll rev his bike up to match that. And that's not the plan, right? So they're like, hey, just trust what we're trying to execute here. Don't worry about it, what anybody else is doing. You know, he has that light that Get makes that will put him in the right range to what they said. Just trust that. That's what's going to work. It doesn't matter what anybody else is doing around you. You tried that. You were last when you tried that. So I think that's what they just want him to do, is trust what, you know, that the testing they've done and all the work that they put in to set him up, instead of worrying about that he's, because I've been there too. Like, you think, okay, if I'm at, you know, whatever it is, 2,500 RPM, and that's a really low RPM range on the start, you don't think that's enough, but that's what's going to keep you from getting that wheel spin. And that's what's going to give you a smooth delivery. And then great. Yeah. Once you get 10 feet across, you can, you know, ramp it up, but just getting out of there, it's almost better to kind of roll out of there than it is with, you know, a ton of pent up energy trying to grab traction when there really is none.
Yeah. Trust the process, I think they say.
Yep.
That's what I was going to mention, because you said about, we on the podcast previous to this, we talked about the metal starts, and we talked about how on like a private team now, it's really difficult to get a start in MXGP against the factory guys, because it's almost like a MotoGP start, you know, with, it's always the same. They have the bike, all like the people from Japan and stuff with their electrics, and the bike's designed for the optimal start on the metal grid. And yeah, when you see a variable change, like when it gets a little bit wet, that's why you see the guys spin so much, because something's changed. The bike's obviously not, there's less grip on the mesh, and the bike's set up for the optimal conditions of when it's dry. So yeah, I guess I need to hope for some more wet mesh grids this year. And
yeah, it's crazy. I was, and I'm sure you guys are, you're much closer to it than I am, but I listening to Jeremy Sewer over the past couple of years, there's so much testing, of course, with the electronics, but also on the clutch, to get the delivery of the clutch perfected, different plates, different engagement points. Like they've, it sounded like he and Yamaha were putting in a ton of effort to get the clutch perfected for that delivery. So exactly what you're saying, on a private team, yeah, I mean, you have maybe one or two options. Your possibilities of changing the internals on the clutch are very limited, versus Yamaha, where they can build all sorts of things. They can go hydraulic or cable or different, all sorts of different plate thicknesses and all those things. It's a really challenging thing to try to compete with those riders. And it's probably only going to get harder. You know, the better the electronics get, the wider the gap becomes.
I don't know if they have in America as well, but do they have the lasers when they're testing the starts in America at the test tracks and stuff that you know of?
I haven't heard of it. I haven't heard of that, but it wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah, because over here they always with the laser beams, you know, from one point to one point, and then off the metal start, you can always get the exact, if you change something on the clutch, if it's the exact time, rather than some going on the stopwatch going, yeah, I think that was 0.1 faster. It's actual, they have the actual laser beam set up. So
yeah, I'm sure it's probably,
yeah, I mean,
here now.
Yeah, almost every factory team does that over here, but I don't know. I guess in America as well, they maybe have it as well. I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's really cool to hear. And obviously another man that obviously hunts. Have you got an update on him? I think Steve was saying, Steve Mathis, that he might be out for a couple of races with that shoulder injury. Obviously came at a bad time with him gaining some really good momentum in previous weeks. Have you got any update on Hunter's condition, JT?
I haven't heard anything specifically, but I can tell you Hunter is a really tough kid. Watching him last summer, you know, he was hurt nearly the entire time of that motocross championship last year. And it wasn't until the finale in LA that he finally said, I can't do it. Because I'm not exaggerating at all. Every single moment that he was not racing on a weekend during the summer, he was doing therapy and rehab and on a massage table and hooked up to a machine. It was never ending, because yeah, he was leading the championship and needed to do everything possible to stay out there. So I haven't heard if he'll be out there, but I can tell you that if there's a way to possibly show up and race, he'll do it. That kid, he has earned my respect as far as being tough and being willing to go through pain to show up on Saturdays.
And it's impressive. Obviously, you were saying how much money he gave up at that SMX as well, wasn't it? So, you know, if he sort of had to sit that one out, you know, it must have been pretty bad. And then he came back and did the Nations too. So,
yeah, I mean, just on paper, and you don't know what it's going to look like, but he was leading the points. So I'm going to assume that. I mean, it was 484,000 is what he left on the table outside of whatever Honda or Alpine Stars or whoever was going to pay him. That was just what's publicized. So when I understood he was unwilling to race in that scenario, I mean, you have to just understand that he can't, like, he physically cannot race in that scenario, because he would go through, and anybody would, right? All of us on this would go through whatever amount of pain possible to show up and race when you're leading the points. But if you can't, you can't. And I thought he handled it really well. He was mature. I probably would have thrown a chair through some sort of glass window, but I thankfully, he had a good year and had already won two championships. Otherwise, it would have been much tougher, I'm sure, to swallow.
If we just move on to MXGP, if that's right with Adam and Ed, just because you haven't got a long time, JT.
Yeah.
How do you sort of see the MX2 field and championship sort of panning out? Obviously, Geertz is moved out to MXGP, and he's arguably been the fastest guy in MX2, especially over the last couple of years. Obviously didn't get the title every time, but been the fastest at least. Do you see Adamo coming out with a ton of confidence and sort of running away with this thing, or do you see Kaido Wolf being a bit more consistent in that top three, or someone like Beniston making a run at sort of being up there week in, week out, not just sort of like the flash in the pan that we've seen in years prior?
Well, I'm interested to see who kind of steps up and is the alpha of this class, because I don't think there really is one right now. You know, Adamo won the championship, and that's great. Congratulations to him. But in my mind, Geertz was the best rider last year, and through his own crashes and injuries, he was not champion. And it's amazing to me that he's left the class without accomplishing that. But the rest of these riders, any of them, I mean, you could make a case for DeWolf or even Lucas Kunin, or, you know, Adamo doing it again. Simone Langenfelder certainly is capable. Beniston, if he can harness his best form each and every week, he can be that guy, you know. So there's a lot. Obviously, it's a shame that Liam Everts is going to miss some time. But to me, it's more of who is going to step up, who's going to take the reins that first Tom Vial left, and then now Yago kind of left too. Because I think everybody was kind of deferring to Yago until he kind of crashed his way out of the championship. So now the door truly is wide open, and who is going to step up and kind of take command as the rider that everybody else is looking to? I don't think anybody is right now. I think everybody in that group fancies themselves as being world champion. And of course, we know that only one of them is going to get it done.
Yeah. Do you, and just sort of being a fly guy, what do you think about Adamo not running the number one plate? Like, how much would that be worth to a company like Fly, having, obviously he's in Alpine Stars, but if you were in Fly, how much would that be worth to a company like yours to have a guy out there with that could run the number one plate but is opted not to?
Yeah, it's a pretty big deal. I would be bummed, no question. I'd be disappointed, because for the casual fan, someone that's not, let's say, not us, right, that's watching everything completely dialed in, we know everything about everyone. The average fan doesn't know. You know, they're not going to know that Andrea is the former champion, and that all of the glory and fame and attention that goes along with that. So you miss that whole window of it. And it was such a big deal in America that they forced these riders, because for a while they didn't have to. They took that away. They didn't have to do it anymore. So like when you saw Carmichael running number four so many times, he didn't have to run the one. And between them wanting to promote the sport and help ease of viewership for casual fans, because it was on, you know, live television America every single week, and they want to create superstars out of these riders, they felt it was so important that they forced them to do it, right? Because I don't think Chase Sexton, I think Sexton would like to run number four or 23. You know, some of these guys would like to run, like Eli Tomac ran number three many times when he was champ. So I think it's just, I think it's important. I would be bummed. I understand the branding side for the riders, that they want to, you know, like Jeffrey Herlings, everyone knows he's 84. You know, I understand that side of it too. But I think if it was me, there's no question in my mind, I would run number one. You don't know if you're ever getting that opportunity ever again. There's no chance you would be able to talk me out of running number one.
I won a little Nora British Cup thing over in the UK last year, and you better believe I'm running number one this year. Like,
yeah. So, I mean, it's your kid's like, dream, right? Like, it's earned. Exactly. You're a world champion. Yeah.
I get what you said about the branding and things, but I just don't see Adamo as being such household name that the number 80 is recognized with his name.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
he's not selling merchandise based off of that number 80, right? You know.
No, and like, I don't even remember the last time someone ran the number one plate in the MXGP class. Like, off the top of my head, I mean, yeah.
I think for your first world title, you should always run the number one. Maybe if you're multiple world champion, then okay. But I think
for the OEMs, it's a huge deal, right? For KTM to be able to put a number one on their 450s, 450 SXs, and sell them like that, I would want to do that if I'm KTM, right? And that's a huge marketing thing for the average person that doesn't know any better. Like they're like, oh damn, look at KTM has ones on it, which is earned. But you know, that's, I don't know. I think 100%. There's a lot to it. I'm surprised that there's not more pushback about riders choosing not to run it.
Yeah, the last person that this must be wrong that I can think running the number one is Pishon on an RM250. That can't, I can't be
it's
right,
been a long
surely,
time.
But
it's difficult because you never know when you're going to get that chance again. And obviously, last year with Yago getting injured and Simon getting injured, like you look at the numbers, like Paul Piercy sent us, and you know, he only had one qualifying race win. Adamo, he only led seven laps in the qualifying race, and he only won two GPs, and he only led 66 laps, which in compared to Yago, he led 208 laps, Simon 141, and even Kuhn 91. You may as well run it when you get the chance, shouldn't you?
I certainly would. You'd have to tear it away from me. I mean, that's obviously he has the right to choose, but like you said, this may be your one shot to ever run the number one plate as being world champion. I would soak in every lap of it.
Do you sort of have any particular favorites for Argentina? Obviously, Simon's been very impressive going into the season in those preseason races, and Evans will be missing, which is really disappointing for him because he would have definitely had him up there to back himself to get it done. And you look at Zanchi on the HRC, obviously they're renewing that 250 factory effort, and he's been really fast. And like we were saying before, he's obviously, they said they're basing that bike on the 250 the Lawrence brothers had great success on, and he's working with Jackie Vimon. So he's got a good framework around him, and obviously he showed what he was all about last year in EMX and when he did the MX2 race in France, just like his teammate Rossi, who's on the factory gas. So who do you see as some of those contenders for Argentina? Do you think some of those guys, and obviously the Koonin brothers, DeWolf, do you have a particular favorite for that surface? Because there's a bit of a different beast, isn't it, like we were saying?
Yeah, I think Simone will be strong. You know, he was great every time he wasn't injured really last year. But I look at riders like Kai and Koonin as they really ride well when they're on the edge, and they like to go fast. You look at a rider like Benestan, he's so technically gifted that I don't know that this is the perfect track for him. It doesn't mean he can't do well. I just don't know if it sets up as well for riders who like to really take chances. This track rewards riders who are willing to absorb a lot of risk and like riding on that edge, because this track asks for that. Even it can get you in a lot of trouble. We've seen huge crashes over the years at this race. But I think to win here, you have to be willing to push the edge. You know, you can't pick your way around it and be the most technically sound rider. You kind of have to be on the edge of control at times. That's who I would look for, is the rider who can do that, absorb it, but then not go too far over the edge too. I'm glad I don't have to do it, because I would be terrible at that. I didn't like taking all those chances. But when you watch a rider like Lucas Kuhn, and you can just see it, you can see he is ready to take on whatever risk you throw at him. So I could see him coming out and doing really well this opening weekend.
Yeah, I think it's also obviously part of the 20 round championship. It's also how much risk you're willing to take at the first round. As a rider's point of view, yeah, I know if I was going for the title in MX2 or something, or MXGP, that you're willing to take some risk at the first round, but not to ruin the championship. So I feel like there's a lot of that going on as well.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I would say you're older and wiser than some of these kids are going to be when that gate drops. I watch some of the decisions they make both here.
Do you think
and
it's
there,
a,
kids that are
it's
17,
a bit of a
18
quick
and
track to have the first round at, like to have all your star guys there just having to hang it out to go for a win? Do you think maybe they're better off going to a track with a bit of a slower pace to start the year?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, I don't know how much of that is even weighed, right? Like, it just seems like, what does the calendar say? What are the governments of the countries say as far as timing? When do they want the race there? I wish there was a little bit more of that, but I don't even know that that's a consideration, to be honest.
Yeah,
I think there is some sort of like Mataly has to be within some certain point of the year. No, it can't be in the summer. I think,
right, yeah, it's each hunting season or whatever's going on. Yeah,
so I think it isn't as easy as, like, they can pick when they have the GP. I think there is some sort of, I don't know exactly how it works, but I think there is some sort of like that. But going back to the track, I think, I don't know, I think Argentina's, yeah, okay, there's been some crashes there, but apart from Fevre getting injured in the waves and Cairoli on the jump, I'd say Argentina's a pretty safe track as far as injuries go, as a rider from riding there.
Yeah, that's good to hear.
I think the more, from previous experience, the more slower technical tracks where you jar your ankle or twist your knee or the front can slide away without expecting it, I think they're more, like Arco, for example, them type tracks are a little bit more where there's no room for error. Like at Argentina, you can go off the track in most places. Another reason why it's a little bit similar to America, like in Europe, a lot of the tracks, if you go off the track in some places, that could be your career over.
Yeah.
So I would put Argentina as a pretty safe track in my opinion, compared to some of the others. It's just, maybe the mistakes happen there because it is the first round and everyone's a bit excited or wants to do good or, not in the groove of racing.
Yeah, well said. That's really good insight. And obviously, moving on to the MXGP class, JT, how do you think someone like Prado approaches it? Obviously, he'll probably be heading almost definitely to Supercross next year. He's had that Supercross this year. He's done really well, probably exceeded expectations in many people's eyes. And probably just more of the same, isn't it? Managing races, like what did he, 14 qualifying race wins, 61% of total laps led in those qualifying races, and just manage it through race one, obviously still keeping everyone honest, but just got the two GP wins and he led, 32% of all the laps in the races. So how do you think Prado approaches it? And I guess, is he your favorite, or are you putting your cards in the Geyser or Hurlings or Fever or Sewer basket?
Yeah, I mean, Jorge, he'll be good. I don't know. I wonder how much his heart is in this year. It felt like last year was this huge box that he checked and it was mission accomplished. I won a world championship, and I'm almost positive he's coming to America for 2025. So of course he'll be trying. No one wants to go to the race and not try. I don't know. Will we see the same effort? Will we see the same level of performance? Because everybody seems to be ready this year. Geiser's back. Jeffrey's fully healthy and ready to go. Febre's got the Kawasaki figured out. Maybe he goes out and wins it again. I think it's going to be a tougher fight than it was a year ago, where we just saw him win every time on Saturday and a lot of winning on Sunday. I think there's going to be a little bit more parity. And if anything, my pick would be Jeffrey Hurlings. I have a rule: if Jeffrey Hurlings is healthy and racing, I pick him to win. That doesn't always work out because he's hurt often and doesn't finish series far too often, but when he's there and when he sees the checkered flag, he usually is the one that sees it first.
Yeah, I think it's hard to argue with that. I think Lewis Phillips put a picture of his results up on Twitter earlier on that showed just like the amount of races he missed with the amount of races that he'd raced and like what positions they were. And it was predominantly ones. Yeah, it's pretty much if he finishes the season, he's done every round, he wins the world title. Kind of hard to bet against a guy like that. It does kind of seem his character has kind of changed coming into this year. He's seems a lot more relaxed. I seen an interview with him at Hawkstone, and they were talking. He was just saying like, he's glad he hasn't got a race against Jet and things like that. I mean, it's all said in jest, and when push comes to shove, I'm sure he'd give Jet a good run for his money. But he just seems more relaxed, and I think he's not feeling that pressure of having to go out and dominate like he used to in years past.
Yeah, I agree. I couldn't imagine him 3 or 4 years ago kind of giving Jet the praise and admiration that he did. He would be too concerned with having to face him later, or there would be too much pride there for him to do that. That's normal. I think that comes with maturation. He understands he's won 101 GPs or whatever it is. I don't think anybody's questioning his legacy at this point. So you can be a little bit more gracious. And I think that's what's a lot of people have been asking for him his whole career, is be more gracious. Everybody thinks you're the best. You think about guys like Jeremy McGrath. He was like the nicest guy, and he was winning. Some people can't do that, but it was nice to see him kind of lower the defense mechanism a little bit and talk, laudingly about someone else, because we certainly do it about him and about him all the time, and he deserves it.
Yeah, and obviously you go back to Argentina last year and Herling's had that immense second moto after sort of just an average first moto. Once he got in his groove, he's just almost impossible. Like we were saying before, he's one of those few guys that can actually get through the pack in MXGP because it's so stacked. Despite that, he can still do it. And obviously you look back to that battle with Cairoli years ago that was famous. But I guess Geyser is pretty good at Argentina too. And on the new bike, they've been getting some good pre-season races. He's looked very impressive, both leading from the front and coming through the pack. Even though it's just pre-season, like we saw last year, Jeremy Seale was imperious in pre-season. It didn't really translate into the opener. He had a huge get off and he was sort of struggling to build that momentum. So do you see Fernandez having a good season as well as Geyser, as you know, his teammate obviously won it last year in Argentina? How do you sort of see those guys shaping up? And also, before we let you go, I'd love your thoughts on Yago as well, moving up to the 450 class. Obviously you saw what he did at Red Bud in person, mate, and in many races he's a fair weapon on a dirt bike. So if he can just sort of stop the crashes, he should be a pretty good success in MXGP.
Yeah, it's pretty wide open, really. I think there are several guys that can and will win. You know, it's just similar to what's happening in AMA Supercross. As the season goes on, the gaps start to widen a little bit. Riders get a little injured. They start to lose a little bit of confidence, and the cream kind of rises to the top. So I would expect lots of parity, different results. Guys like Vlaanderen moving to the factory team. Like, there's going to be a lot of change and guys that we may not expect to be as good. You know, you think about what Vlaanderen will be able to do at a track like Roa Sardo. You know, like, he could be right in the mix. You know, his equipment's going to be better. So I think we're going to see different guys winning at different times. It's just going to be who can consistently stay up there through every condition on different continents and not give away 30 or 40 points on a weekend. Those are the weekends that just kill you. And when a championship is this long. So, you know, these guys with all the experience, Fevre and Geyser and Herlings and Prado, they know what championships look like. So yes, they want to win. That's what they're driven and programmed to do, but they also understand that they're going to be racing into late September battling the same championship. So what things look like in early March may not look the same in May or June or September. So you just kind of have to hang in there, take the wins when they come, get as many points as possible, and not get too worked up if things don't go your way on a certain weekend, because they're likely not. You're going to have ups and downs, and that's what happens when you have a 20 race calendar. There's just going to be a lot of stuff in between, but I think it's just hard. And until you go through it for those riders, it's hard to kind of wrap your head around racing for that long at that level and understanding that, yeah, the championship is not going to be decided in Argentina, right? You just want to get through it and create some momentum. So when you get back to Europe, you kind of know what you're dealing with. But yeah, it's, I love the fact that it's so deep. It's not always been that way in the USA. This year it is in Supercross. Last summer in the US, it was not at all. It was one of the weakest 450 fields I've ever seen. So when I look at the MXGP field, I just see talent all the way through it. And it's an incredible time for MXGP.
Yeah, it is. They got to probably capitalize on it when they have all these big stars, because you never know. Herlings, Fevre, Jeremy Seewa, you know, they're not going to be around forever. So I guess there's so many American listeners that tune in to listen to you, mate. So just, that's a pretty good sort of advertisement for MXGP, what you're saying there, mate. So we just encourage any listeners from the USA to enjoy it. And just, there's so many storylines to follow, and the racing's just as good as America, isn't it, mate? Even though the sort of the coverage and the, maybe it's not as well promoted, but it's definitely a lot to enjoy, isn't it, mate?
Yeah, it's tough. I think for many Americans, the names and the accents, and most Americans have never been to Europe. So it seems like, you know, they're racing on a different planet at times. But in the end, they're still racing a motocross bike, and they're doing the same exact thing that you have done your whole life growing up as a kid racing. It just happens to be somewhere else, and maybe they speak a different language than you do. But in the end, once you put your helmet on and the motorcycle starts up, it's the same thing. So, I hope that people can get past that. And because if you can't handle the names and whatever, turn it off, turn something on. Because I promise you, if you just watch what's on the screen, you're going to be highly entertained if you know what you're looking at. Because the pace that MXGP has right now is nothing short of impressive. You know, different subject, but people were asking me how we were going to do at Motocross of Nations this past year. And I told pretty much everyone we were going to get our asses kicked, just because I knew A, it wasn't our best that we had to offer. And B, we're going to a French track that's really challenging, ruddy, difficult, off camber, low traction environment. So I kind of knew the ambush we were walking into. And it just speaks to, the level of performance in MXGP right now is no joke. If anybody doesn't understand that or hasn't wrapped their head around that, then please go watch one and you will be very impressed.
You certainly know that firsthand, don't you, mate?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. The thing is with MXGP, you have such a variety of tracks, which is, what makes it even more difficult over such a period of time, over the whole of the world, all different compounds, different split tracks, rutty tracks, deep sand, little bit of sand, hard sand, wet. Yeah, the variety is difficult at times. But what I was going to ask you, JT, is what do you think MXGP could improve from looking at from an American side? I know we said about you going on the track and showing the track in a bit more in depth. I think that's something cool. But what else, from your point of view, would you like to see MXGP improve?
Some of the track conditions sometimes to me are just a bit dangerous. Having a like some of the times I've been at Twitchenthal and the track's rock hard base, they don't do any track maintenance and they just dump truckloads of water on top of it. That's just asking for big crashes and lots of difficulty for riders. And there's no margin for error whatsoever. Some of those things I just shake my head at. I don't think you have to go as far as the USA does where you're just working on the track all the time. There could be a happy balance there. But I think the track stuff is probably my number one. I think for MXGP to grow, just trying to engage with the American market as much as they can. There are lots of fans here that the gap is just too big, right? Whether it's, lots of different culture and languages, and they have a hard time. For me, it's no big deal. I've been going to Europe since I was 18. But for many, they just can't wrap their head around it. So I don't have the answer to it, but that's when I speak to other people about, why don't you watch MXGP? They just are like, I can't get into it. I don't have any background of these riders and I don't even know where that country is that he's from. And, like when Geiser's winning the world championship, they didn't even know that was a country that he's from. You know what I mean? And that's just the ignorance of our fans at times. I get it. But if you've never been to Europe, your experience with it is zero. So I would love to see more American engagement because I think the product of where MXGP has come from, or, go back 20 years, the level now is remarkable. These guys are going so damn fast. And I don't think they necessarily get the respect they deserve.
Yeah, I agree on the both things you said. Going back to the tracks, I guess you was in Twitchenthal last year, correct? Or
yeah, yes, I was.
Yeah, that was one of the GPs I did last year, and it was like, yeah, even speaking brutal to the other riders in the after, everyone was saying, yeah, even they were scared to ride around. Like you was the big finish line jump that you have there, you was landing immediately into ruts all the way to the corner, and then so you had about, if you come up short, you would bounce into the ruts and you'd have to land the landing completely perfect to be able to enter the ruts correct. Otherwise, if you jump too far, you're also landing into the ruts. So I mean, yeah, like you said, a bit
there's
smart track prep.
It's a bit much. I don't think it has to be perfect. It shouldn't be a brand new racetrack every time, but some consideration of the safety factor, I think at times is lacking.
And also sometimes at the MXGP, we have, I know we mentioned before about the green mesh, Brad, but they have now, like there's places on the side of the track where they build mud mounds, like with a digger, which is like vertical edges, and they have them like with gaps in between. So it's even on places where like you wouldn't even ride off the track there because there's like a sprinkler hose and big boulders or a big cliff drop, or like no one's ever going to cut the track there, but they have these things. So at Teuschenthal, I broke my hand on one 3 years ago, and Watson did also. The same, different parts of the track at Teuschenthal, but on the same thing. Like you save having a big crash and you go a little bit off the track and then you hit one of these vertical mud mounds that they build, And yeah, you save a big crash and then you have a big crash if you hit one of these things.
Hey guys, I got to jump. I got a meeting in 1 minute, but enjoy the weekend.
Yeah, thanks again for joining us, mate, and all the best.
No worries, guys. Thank you. See you. Good to talk with you.
Cheers, mate. Yeah, obviously, like you were saying there, Adam, you look at that Arnhem GP last year with the fence, the trees, there was like no space at all. Obviously, it's great to have the fans really close, but that was pretty dangerous and sketchy for a lot of those fans too, and riders especially. You know, it's hard enough as it is, but just having that sort of minimal room for error when you're racing, it makes it even harder when you get off.
Yeah, I mean, at some tracks, you're never going to combat. Like Ernie, for example, if you go off the track some places there's nothing you can do about it because that's just what there is there, you know? But I don't know. I don't know what's wrong with like the air hay bales that they have in America, like the ones that are just air, you know, that just move out of the way when you hit them. I don't know why we can't just have them. Or yeah, because I've seen so many people crash because of these mounds or just a bit smarter with the tracks. But yeah, it's I think there's quite a lot of things they can improve. But maybe you say that for another time and get JT's opinion on a lot of other things. That's a thing. I think that's an interesting discussion you can have about the whole of Emmett slagging it too much.
Yeah, what's your thoughts on it, Brad? Obviously, some of those Ram trucks are in some interesting positions sometimes, you hear various people say. So your take on it quickly?
I got an interesting story in a minute, Brad, about that.
I think just sometimes it's not thought about fully. Obviously, they don't tend to park them on the first turn, but you kind of want to put it in a good spot that cameras are going to see it and the fans are going to see it and the things like that. And like Adam said about sometimes they just build these like vertical walls on the edges of tracks for sort of no real reason. Then you think there'd probably be better ways to help people get off the track and back on the track a bit safer. But obviously, like Adam says, some places there are just governed by what is there. And like if you go over the top of Talladega and Glen Helen, you're most likely not going to come back up. But some places, building these massive walls, like it seems like the first turn in Mantua, they just stick like a massive sand wall there, which should just send you to the moon if you hit it. But yeah, I mean, it just seems unnecessary, but yeah, I don't really have a solution.
Only one time I've ever seen one of them sand mounds come in useful is when Bobrushev landed on one from the moon. At Mantua. That was the only time I think I've ever seen one of them actually. I think that really saved him there. But going back to the story, in 2017... my shock broke when I was on CLS. So I had outside gate pick in Arco. And I come from the outside and I had quite a good start. I got pushed over that big mound that they had in the first turn there. And then not only did I survive the big mound there, but then they had the Fox hole shot thing there. So I had to avoid the scaffolding of that. And in the meantime, duck under the massive cables that hold it into the ground, which nearly decapitated me. And then after the race, I got penalised for cutting the track. So I said, all right, you can penalise me for cutting the track. Okay, that's fair, whatever. But you need to think where you put the hole shot things, because if I didn't duck and one of them, and it's not like a little tie strap, it's like one of them massive, it's like one to the side of a lorry, you know? If you go into that at speed with your neck, it's obviously really dangerous. And to have that on the outside of a corner of the first turn, I get it. They sponsor the thing, but there's got to be another safer way to, like an air one or something that's safer than having these big four ratchet straps on a metal structured hole shot thing on the outside of a turn.
Yeah.
With no padding.
No padding.
Yeah.
But there's things that I think
just to finish up on, you said about the air ones. I know you, I think you might have been racing actually British Championship at Farley Castle. They had an air banner and the generator ran out of fuel midway through the race, and it's just like people plowing into this sort of arch, it just fell down.
That's why you need a half one, you know, that it doesn't go over the track. It goes like either side.
Yeah,
Or just
I
make
think,
sure
yeah.
someone's topping up the Jenny with fuel.
That's good. That's been an awesome podcast, that lads. Any final thoughts before we wrap this one up? Starting with you, Adam.
No final thoughts. Just excited to get the season underway, and was good to chat with you boys. I'm excited to, unfortunately, not excited to not be racing Argentina. I wish I was there, but yeah, I'm a fan as well as a rider, so I'm excited to watch it and see how it pans out. And yeah, hopefully everyone stays healthy and we see the racing all year long.
Yeah, same here, really just ready to get things rolling now.
Yeah, well said, mate. And obviously, thanks, JT and Fly Racing, for coming on board this podcast as well. It's been a ripper chat, and definitely look forward to speaking to lads, and enjoy the weekend.
Cheers, mate.
Yeah, cheers, guys.
Thanks,
Thanks.
lads. Have a good one.